Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, your host today, and it's my great pleasure to be joined by two exceptional historians. With me are James Morton Turner, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Wellesley College, and Andrew Eisenberg, Hall Distinguished Professor of American History at the University of Kansas. Together, they are the authors of The Republican Reversal: Conservatives and the Environment from Nixon to Trump, published just a few days ago by Harvard University Press. Dr. Turner, Dr. Eisenberg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, this is a marvelous piece of work. It's clearly written, persuasively argued, very well situated for classrooms next spring or holiday shopping next month for all you out there. The book draws, and it really draws on the rich flurry of recent scholarship on the history of the GOP and the rise of the right, which is kind of one of the richest veins of recent scholarship in history. So I wonder, what are some of the ways that the Republican Party has changed in the last 50 years that best helps to explain what you're calling its reversal on environmental politics?
Well, the short answer to that, Brian, is about the dwindling of the moderate tradition within the Republican Party, which began in the 1960s, and the rise of conservatism. And really, one of the things we were trying to do in the book was to draw in exactly what you referred to, that scholarship on the rise of conservative republicanism, and bring that into the study of recent environmental politics, which is not something that has happened in an extensive way. So what are some of the ways that the Republican Party changed that rise of conservatism? There was pretty clearly a geographical shift in the party. It started to elect more of its officials from the South and the West. And I think we focus on the West in the book because of the way in which conservative Republicans coming out of the West were challenging federal land management policies. There's a complicated role of the evangelical right. For the rise of Ronald Reagan, the moral majority in the late 1970s was really important. The evangelical right, though, didn't initially take much of a stand on environmental politics. They had other things on their agenda. But in a way, what kind of intrigues me about the rise of conservatism and the way that played out in environmental politics is that moderate Republicans had supported environmental laws in the 1960s and the early 1970s. And even some conservative Republicans had supported environmental laws. Barry Goldwater did. He was one of the co-sponsors of the Clean Air Act. And Ronald Reagan had a pretty decent record in environmental terms when he was governor of California. But I think that these Republicans had always been opposed to a lot of the government regulation from the New Deal and the Great Society. They couldn't figure out a way, or didn't necessarily want to oppose environmental regulations. They saw that as being in a different category. And that started to fall apart in the 1970s, particularly with the oil crisis. I think Reagan saw an opportunity there to add environmental regulations to the kinds of ways that he'd been excoriating other kinds of economic regulations for a long time.
And there's actually two documents that you bring in early in the book that I think kind of jump off the page and grab readers and point toward sort of what were divergent futures for the GOP. And one I'm thinking of is the 1972 Republican Party platform, and the other is what you call the Powell Memo, or what people call the Powell Memo. Could you tell our listeners a bit about each one of those and how they fit into the larger story?
Sure. Brian, this is Jay. I'll take this question. You can go back and you can look at these laws that were passed, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and see, you know, just how strong the bipartisan support was, see how many members, you know, overwhelming majorities from both parties, right, who are voting for these laws. But then I think one of the things that surprised me was to actually go and look at the 1972 Republican Party's platform and, you know, single out those sections that were about the environment. And, you know, what I didn't expect to see was that the Republican Party was, you know, seeing it as so important to respond to environmental issues that they were really positioning themselves as ahead of the Democrats on the issue. And this was an issue that they wanted to claim at that time. It seemed that urgent. So, you know, you you read through it and there are lines in there about kind of the sweeping environmental message that the Nixon administration has been sending to Congress in the early 1970s, that they're, you know, concerned about air quality and water quality and toxic waste substances and ocean dumping, right? This long list. And, you know, their point is Nixon's been sending these issues to Congress, and Congress, the Democratic Congress, hasn't been active, right? That they've been languishing in the opposition Congress. That's some of the language from the platform. You know, so that's, you know, surprisingly strong statement about the Republicans' commitment to environmental reform. But you put that in contrast with the Powell memo. So the Powell memo, very different document. soon to be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell drafted this document and the early 1970s, and it really, you know, reflected this tension in the Republican Party, where on the one hand, certain Republicans, moderate Republicans, were concerned about regulation and environmental issues, but then this other branch, the emerging conservative wing of the Republican Party, you know, saw in this whole host of regulations, you know, everything from occupational regulations to fiscal regulations to consumer regulations to new environmental regulations, a real threat to the free enterprise market. And they, you know, saw the mobilization from the 1960s, interest group mobilization, grassroots organization. And the Powell memo really kind of put it to the business community, that the business community needed to step forward, to engage in the policy process, to advocate for itself, to defend its interests in ways that it had not done in the 1960s. It really, you know, it warned that, you know, if this didn't happen, kind of politicians were going to stampede, you know, to support all of these new regulatory policies that were being put into place. So if the free market was going to survive, the American business community needed to really vigorously, you know, work to preserve that free enterprise system. And so that's the beginning of the mobilization of conservative Republicans, or it's one of the beginnings of the mobilization of conservative Republicans, industry, the conservative think tanks that they ally themselves with, they help create, they help support, that you know, leads to this kind of collision of this environmental push of the 1970s and the conservative Republicans, you know, kind of how they collide at the start of the Reagan administration.
And again, Reagan is this pivotal figure in your book, as, of course, and especially in its chapters on public lands that Drew mentioned, and air and water and public health. And you write that it was Reagan, you know, bringing these Western politics to D.C., which gloomily at one point you observed that, you know, sort of has become the norm now. We all live in the West now, but that Reagan brings these politics east and then, quote, broke with the nation's help. You know, the Reagan administration broke with the nation's bipartisan commitment to environmental protection and ushered in the beginnings of the Republican reversal. How did he do that?
Well, he wasn't acting alone. This is Drew, by the way. He wasn't acting alone. He kind of rode in on a wave of anti-federal feeling that was bubbling up in the West that has been called the Sagebrush Rebellion. There were a number of state legislatures in the West that were upset about some new regulations about the management of public lands that had gone through in the middle of the 1970s. And I think Nevada was the first state to have its state legislature pass a resolution taking back all the federal land within its state boundaries, which is, of course, legally completely moot. It has no effect at all. But other state legislatures in the West followed along, and Reagan perceived that this was a kind of winning issue. It clearly was sort of symbolic politics. It was a way to beat up on Washington without really having to take any consequences for what you were saying. And so at some point in the run-up to his 1980 campaign, he said, count me in as a sagebrush rebel. So he was kind of being swept in that respect. But I think that one of the other things he did was that he intuited that he could critique environmental regulations in the same way that he'd been critiquing other kinds of economic regulations. And he could kind of add that to one of the things that he was criticizing about the Democratic legacy stretching back to the New Deal and the Great Society. For a long time, in his stump speech when he was traveling around for General Electric and when he was supporting Goldwater, the term he had used in his stump speech was that he didn't want Americans to let what he called a little intellectual elite, that was his term, in a far distant capital, tell you how to run your lives. They think they know better how to run your life than you do. And he added environmental regulations into this in his run for the presidency in 1980. And so I think so it both came from his conservative ideology and it came in the moment in this sort of Western response to federal regulation. So when he got into office, you know, in a big sense, there are two kinds of things that he tried to do. It's more complicated than that, but we'll just talk about those two things. One was to ramp up the production of fossil fuels on federal lands. And the person who put that program into effect for him was his Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, who opened up leasing for coal and oil and natural gas on federal lands and also oil drilling offshore. That there had been a kind of bipartisan consensus for a long time, particularly on offshore oil drilling, to keep that relatively limited. That was a kind of consensus that had emerged after the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill. And James Watt just kind of shoved through that and said, we're going to open this up and we're going to do this on a much larger scale than has been done before. And I'll just say as an aside, that became the new bipartisan consensus. And that level of oil production and fossil fuel production on federal lands and offshore holdings continued for the next 30 or 40 years until halfway through the Obama administration. And the other thing he tried to do was to roll back regulations having to do with clean air and clean water. And he certainly didn't want to address something like acid rain. This is a tricky thing because it's kind of like the dog that didn't bark, but acid rain was an extraordinary challenge in the 1980s, and the Reagan administration dragged its heels about doing anything about that. He did do something toward the end of his second term, reach an international agreement about ozone, the ozone hole. But for the most part, the second thing he tried to do was to sort of not over-regulate industry and these kinds of effects on air and on water. I think he had, relatively speaking, less success at that than in ramping up fossil fuel production. Part of the reason was that the person he put in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency, Ann Gorsuch, had to leave after a couple of years because of various problems she had, both ethically and in terms of management. But I think the other reason for that is that Americans, although they may have wanted cheaper fossil fuels, they also wanted clean air and clean water, and they were more concerned about these kinds of pollution problems.
It's commonplace when sketching out the history of environmental politics to, you know, you call 1970s, you know, have Earth Day, then you call 1970s the environmental decade, and you rattle off the many legislative achievements from, you know, NEPA up to Superfund. And you begin the book, though, importantly, with a reminder that the passage of a law is never the end of the story. And just as important, you write, is how a law is implemented and litigated and defended. And so you run into the 80s and you see what the Reagan administration is doing. Although I'll say, though, in these chapters, I was really struck by, and you know, I understood the Reagan administration's, you know, position and attempts here to roll a lot of that back. But I was really struck by how much worse it could have been. You know, in those middle chapters, you show the many ways that they attempted to take the teeth out of these laws, but that, you know, they kept running into obstacles and challenges. And so could you say a bit about what some of those, what kind of kept them from doing more of what they wanted to do?
Yeah, this is Jay. And, you know, your question gets at a much larger issue. And, you know, there's a chart in the very beginning of our book, which is drawn from the League of Conservation Voters. And the League of Conservation Voters has been kind of grading politicians on their environmental voting record since the early 1970s. And if you look at this chart, it won't surprise most listeners to this podcast that you see this dramatic divergence, right, between Democrats and Republicans from the 1970s up to today, where, you know, they were really quite close to one another back in the early 1970s. And now Democrats tend to vote 90% or greater, going to get a good score from the League, and Republicans tend to be 5 or 10%. And I think, you know, looking, you know, my students, if they look at that graph, they often assume, well, you know, this divergence means that nothing's happening in Congress, that, you know, it's a state of gridlock in terms of environmental policy and politics. And, you know, when we say that, you know, passing the law, you know, that's not the end of the story. And it's because there are so many different ways in which environmental policy can be made and unmade. And kind of in focusing on this in our book, we're one of our inspirations was a really great book that was published, right, 8 or 9 years ago now by Chris Kleiza and David Sousa on American environmental policy beyond gridlock, where they point out that in this moment of gridlock that we've kind of seen set in on environmental politics over the last 25 years, that's really energized a whole bunch of different pathways by which policy work gets done. So some of that's through the executive branch, some of it's through the courts, some of it's pushing it back down to the state level. But I think the Reagan administration is kind of an early kind of makes clear just how important these processes are going to be, because when Reagan brought in Ann Gorsuch, you know, she was charged with really reworking the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And in some ways, this made sense in the early 1980s. You know, we had, as a country, 10 years of experience implementing these laws, and both kind of everyone agreed there were opportunities to reform them, to make them more efficient and more predictable in terms of how they were being implemented. But Reagan, instead of trying to reform the laws, really, you know, from the perspective of environmentalists, really tried to gut the laws, tried to get rid of federal standards at the national standards and push it back down to the state level, really raise up the role of cost-benefit analysis and put costs at the center of the decision-making process. And these initiatives that the Reagan administration made in terms of these core environmental laws, you know, they ran up against, you know, a lot of political opposition that was rooted in Democrats who were strongly in favor of these laws, but also the moderate Republicans who had helped put the laws into place, many of them in the early 1970s. So, you know, so one of the examples was the Clean Water Act. They tried to shift responsibility for standard setting, what is considered clean, back down to the state level, let the states decide on that, not let the EPA did it. And when they, you know, advanced this proposal, you know, people like John Chafee from Rhode Island you know, were kind of right there, you know, Senator Stafford from Vermont, you know, made clear that they didn't see any room for renegotiating the goals of the Clean Water Act. And as Republicans, you know, they were the ones who were leading the charge and writing letters to Reagan's EPA, you know, explaining that the law's, you know, goals, which were ambitious goals, but they were, you know, I think the language from the memo was something like, they're not a hollow promise. It's a goal that we take seriously. And so, you know, this story repeats itself in the early 1980s, where Reagan tried to roll back these laws, and it was this kind of still strong coalition of moderate Republicans, many of whom hailed from New England and their allies across the aisle, who blocked the Reagan administration's initiatives. When they did that, the Reagan administration then went and tried to implement many of these reforms through administrative reform, through new rules to implement the existing laws. But then those challenges ran up against, came up against headwinds in the courts. And I think one of the other lessons that emerges from the early 1980s is just how important groups like Natural Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Defense Fund, you know, groups that had honed their expertise, had lawyers who were fluent in these laws and able to go to the courts and follow these cases through the courts to ensure that the laws were fully implemented. And because the language of many of these laws is very strong and often very clear, you know, they won a whole series of court cases that blocked the the most kind of aggressive deregulatory initiatives that the Reagan administration advanced.
Can I add something to that answer, Brian? Jay's absolutely right that in some ways, the story of environmental politics since the beginning of the Reagan administration has been the successful ability of environmental organizations to keep these landmark environmental laws Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act on the books and keep them, you know, they continue to be enforced with a kind of integrity, right? And so that has been a success story. And I think one way to read the book is that, well, if your definition of environmental politics is maintaining the integrity of those laws, then the conservative revolt against those laws has been a kind of failure. But another way to look at it is that environmental organizations have had to spend an enormous amount of their energy and their time and their resources fighting a kind of rearguard action to preserve these laws that have been under attack. And that has made it harder for them to push forward on new environmental challenges. And the challenge of acid rain in the 1980s would be one example that, you know, the Sierra Club is trying to fend off James Watt and other groups are trying to work to maintain the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act from Ann Gorsuch's EPA. And nothing happened, or not much of consequence happened on acid rain in the 1980s. And the obvious problem now is climate change, that as environmental organizations are just trying to preserve the laws that are already on the books and get us back to baseline, that takes away from their ability to move us forward on something like climate change.
Yeah, and that's what you turn to in the book's final chapter, The History of Climate Politics. And I think it's really interesting the way that you stress that it's insufficient to explain the GOP's opposition to action on climate change or the rise of climate denial as simply the, you know, them doing the bidding of ExxonMobil and this corporate donor class. Rather, you see it as, you know, part of a conservative's broader retreat from international cooperation on lots of issues, and also a reflection of what you say are really deeply held beliefs in American exceptionalism of different kind of different flavors. Could you unpack that for us?
Jay, you want to take this one? American exceptionalism is kind of your thing here.
Sure, I can.
Jay's a big American exceptionalist, everyone.
You know, they're...
Let me start on it, and then you can add in. Yeah, you know, I do think, right, the usual story is that Republicans have been bought off by the fossil fuel industry, right? And there's a lot of evidence that there are strong ties between fossil fuel interests and the Republican Party, and those ties have grown much stronger over the last 30, 40 years, although they go back in time, into earlier in the 20th century, but that they have played an important role in shaping the Republican Party's approach to energy policy. Drew pointing to Watt's efforts to throw open the offshore lands for oil leasing is an example of this, but then, of course, more recently with climate change. And, you know, so that's a strategy in terms of climate change that goes back to the creation of the George C. Marshall Institute, which is a key think tank on the right, challenging the science around lots of issues, including climate change in the late 1980s and into the 1990s, with the support of Exxon and other groups, and then continuing today with groups like Koch Industries and other think tanks like the Chicago-based Heartland Institute. What clued me in to the fact that kind of that story, just about kind of special interest fossil fuel industries and the Republican Party, that wasn't sufficient, was when I was researching this book. And it's interesting doing research in the 21st century, right? You can stumble onto things like, a YouTube video that somebody shot, right, with their, cell phone or something. But it was in 2010. It was during the Tea Party, and it was a video of a rally that took place on somebody's farm in near Rapid City, South Dakota. And often when we think about the Tea Party, we think about the debates over Obama's healthcare law. But for some activists, equally important was the prospect at that time that we could have a comprehensive climate change bill. So if you remember back in 2009, the Democratic House passed the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill, the American Clean Energy and Security Act. And it was an economy-wide cap on greenhouse gas emissions. It was really, it would have been the kind of first step at a national level to address climate change. And, in retrospect, it seemed impossible that was going to pass. But at the time, it seemed like it might be possible, right? During the election, right? Senator McCain had voiced his commitment to moving this kind of legislation forward. As a Republican candidate, as a Republican senator from Arizona, he had co-sponsored this kind of legislation in the previous years. Obama and voiced his commitment to taking action as well. So it seemed like there was a bipartisan possibility at the time for some kind of market-based strategy. And I think the other thing that is worth mentioning here is that this was a market-based approach to environmental policy, which was exactly what the Republicans had kind of made their own in the early 1990s under George H.W. Bush's administration when they finally did take action on acid rain. So, you know, so one might expect the Republicans to support this kind of market-based approach to the American Clean Energy and Security Act, but that's not what happened. And so back to South Dakota, that rally in South Dakota was part of a hot air tour that Americans for Prosperity, right, a conservative think tank organizing group out of Washington, D.C., had put together. And you know, there were several hundred people at this rally, and the hot air tour featured a red balloon that they took around the country in the summer of 2009 and 2010, and they would float it up over farm fields, and it had a huge and huge letters kind of blazoned on the side. It said, "Cap and trade means lost jobs, higher taxes, and less freedom." And for the activists, you know, who saw this, I mean, what they were doing was explaining, you know, for these, you know, farmers and truck drivers and workers, like, what does cap and trade mean? And, you know, to explain that, you know, they were organizing a grassroots campaign with talking points that, you know, focused on if this law passes, if we address climate change, gasoline's going to cost you $6 to $7. You know, your utility bills are going to more than double. We're going to have to ration energy. But it wasn't just about the numbers. I mean, these conservatives really, you know, focus their campaign as an assault on core American values. So at this rally, you know, they talked about it, this was going to be a loss of our freedoms. And you know, kind of the key point that they made is that if this law was passed, you wouldn't be able to do one of kind of your exercise, one of your most fundamental rights, which was to, you know, enjoy your property, do with your property as you wish. They said, in this law, if it passes, you will not be able to sell your ranch or your home unless you pass a federal government energy audit. The problem was, is that wasn't in the bill at all. You know, in the same way that, you know, there was these organ, you know, kind of outcries over death panels, there was no requirement of a federal government energy audit for all existing properties in this climate bill. But, you know, I think that's the way in which, you know, it's easy to see it as being about, you know, the fossil fuel industry and the Republican Party, but that means ignoring just how much legwork was going into organizing at the grassroots on the right during, you know, the Tea Party era, you know, not just on healthcare, but on these other issues as well. So I think, you know, that's one part of this. Another part of it, because I think this kind of engagement of the grassroots is so important. The other part is Christian evangelicals. And there's a really long and complicated history of how evangelicals have been committed to and opposed environmental reform. And it's different evangelicals who are lining up on either side. But since the early 2000s, there's been a wing of conservatives that's organized around dominion theology, the supposition that Christians were put on earth with dominion over its resources. And from this perspective, fossil fuels are here to lift humanity up, to bring people out of poverty. And you know, when they look and they, you know, examine our climate system, they see it as a divine creation of God and not something that we could possibly perturb by taking advantage of those fossil fuels or burning greenhouse gases. But starting in the, you know, 2006, 2007, you know, there's a lot of organizing among Christian evangelicals to frame the growing concerns around climate change as the work of secular environmentalists who, you know, who were unchristian because they would countenance that humans could somehow upset the fundamental workings of the planet, that that was a real affront to God's wisdom and design. And, you know, as rational as the arguments of these climate scientists and their supporters might seem, you know, they warn their followers not to give in to the temptation to believe the environmentalists and to, you know, rally in opposition to the kinds of policies that they were advancing. So, you know, it's just a lot of work going on amongst conservatives that, you know, went down and really engaged these grassroots, engaged the citizens. To take one more step back, you know, part of your question was about American exceptionalism. And, you know, there was a big shift from the early 1980s or the 1980s or the early 1990s where Drew mentioned earlier, you know, Ronald Reagan was, it was his administration that led the United States to sign on to the Montreal Protocol and take action on the stratospheric ozone hole in 1987. And that becomes kind of one of the core international environmental successes and is seen as a template for action on climate change. And it was a moment when it seemed that kind of the global interest in addressing this environmental issue was something that the United States had to play a role in. And, you know, similarly, at the start of the 90s, it was George H.W. Bush's administration that signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, right? The foundation for all of the climate policy that has come since. And so, you know, the U.S. still was seen as a leader on international environmental policy, you know, through the 1990s. But, you know, in terms of American exceptionalism, I think there are two dimensions to this. I think one is that, you know, by the time you get to the mid-1990s, when actual reductions, caps on greenhouse gas emissions are on the table, conservative Republicans argue that if we were to do that, if we were to limit the United States' ability to burn fossil fuels and put a limit on our greenhouse gas emissions, we would be giving the economic advantage to other countries. Developing countries like China and India. So in 1997, with conservative Republicans spearheading the charge, the Byrd-Hagel resolution was passed. And it made this argument very clearly with a lot of support from Democrats as well, that if we were going to take action on climate change, it was not just going to be countries like the United States, but it needed to be countries, include both developed and developing countries. But that argument has kind of fallen apart recently, right? Because with the Paris Climate Accord, those developing countries did come to the table. And that's what enabled the Paris Climate Accord to be enacted or approved. And I think more recently, what you see in terms of American exceptionalism is that we're doing our part. Even if the United States, you know, conservatives are making the argument, if we're not signing on to something like the Paris Climate Accord or continuing with it, what we are doing is a nation that's truly exceptional in its ability to innovate and harness the free market economy. We're reducing our greenhouse gas emissions without an international commitment, without comprehensive policy. So if you go back and you listen to what Scott Pruitt had to say after President Trump pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord, what he had to say was that thanks to our free market economy and our innovation and our embrace of natural gas fracking, we've actually seen our emissions come down in ways that we expected policy to force us to do. We've accomplished that through kind of our exceptional economy and technological innovations. That was one of Pruitt's big talking points after the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord in 2017. That's kind of a long answer to your question.
No, it's great. And you conclude the book right at that moment. You know, you put your readers in the conclusion in the White House Rose Garden in June of last year on that day when President Trump announced that the nation would withdraw from Paris. And you see it as a moment that really marks how drastically environmental politics have changed since the first Earth Day. And I think I like the way you borrow a thought experiment from the political scientist Roger Pelkey. And you argue that we've gone from what he calls tornado politics to abortion politics when it comes to the environment. What does that mean?
This is Drew. Let me take that one. I think what he meant, or the way we have appropriated his thought experiment, what he laid out was a scenario where you had, say, a school board meeting in some town, and someone rushes in the middle of the meeting and says, "I've just heard there's a tornado coming." And he asks, what would people do in that circumstance? This is a relatively old article. So he said they would turn on the radio. I mean, nowadays, they'd go on their cell phones. They would turn on the radio and they would hear what the experts told them to do. They would listen to the meteorologists. And if they said everybody needs to take cover, they would immediately go and take cover. That a tornado, that kind of exigent situation, is one in which people turn to scientific authority and they do what those scientists tell them need to be done. And essentially, environmental politics in the late 1960s and the early 1970s was tornado politics, that the condition of the air, the condition of the water, the way in which species were threatened with extinction struck a lot of Americans as an exigent situation, much like a tornado on the horizon. That's why 20 million Americans showed up for that first Earth Day in 1970, and 20 million potential voters showing up for an event like that will get the attention of a lot of people. That's why Republicans such as Richard Nixon, who weren't necessarily on board with a lot of the goals of environmentalists, nonetheless signed on to their program in a really strong way. Abortion politics, though, is different. So Pelkey says, if someone rushed into that school board meeting and said, hey, we need to come up with a policy on abortion right away, you're not going to have immediate action, right? That's a situation in which people's values are going to enter into the situation. You may turn to expert authority about it, but the thing about a situation like abortion, or you could say the death penalty, or you could actually put a lot of questions about healthcare into that category as well. Experts have a voice in this, but people's values also have a voice in this. And so one of the things that we suggest in the book is that over the last couple of decades, Republicans have successfully transformed environmental politics from tornado politics, in which people turn to scientists for authority and take their cues about what needs to be done from those scientists. And they've turned that into abortion politics, in which people's values matter as much or more than what the scientists say. And so, as Jay was just saying, and he was answering your previous question, beliefs in American exceptionalism, that American technological ingenuity can find a solution to environmental problems, in many ways, that's a kind of faith-based belief that innovation will find some solution. We don't know yet how they'll do this, but we just have this faith that it will happen. I think Republicans have successfully turned environmental politics toward that, and they did that intentionally because conservatives who opposed environmental regulations were not being very successful playing the game of tornado politics. When they had to defer to scientific authorities, they ended up not getting what they wanted. So they changed the terms of the debate successfully. And I'll just add, you know, in a way that resonates with the current political situation, that kind of abortion politics lends itself really well to the politics of outrage, where people can get incredibly exercised about a particular issue. And not only do they not defer to scientific authority, they just kind of, they'll sort of shut down and not listen to it at all because everybody's views on certain issues where they've tapped into core values are just ratcheted up to such a level that they don't listen to each other anymore.
Yeah, I imagine that a lot of readers, there'll be many readers out there, will pick up this book in search of kind of a path back to a bipartisan golden age of environmental politics. But I would say that in the bipartisan achievements you describe, that there's often, as you mentioned earlier, there's often a moderate or even a liberal Republican kind of there in the center of it. And so you often get Senator Chafee from Rhode Island is often in the middle of these things, or the co-chair of the first Earth Day was Pete McCluskey from, you know, the liberal Republican from California. And after last Tuesday, there are very few Republican Congress people left from California. And so I wonder, has there ever been, or is there, or could there be such a thing as a good faith conservative environmentalist? Is there room in the movement for that?
There's a lot of concern for the environment among Republicans. And, you know, I think evidence of this, and I get, you know, there's a lot of evidence for this, but one piece of evidence is that when Trump's administration kind of put out its first budget, right, one of their core proposals in terms of the environment was slashing the budget for the Environmental Protection Agency. I think they proposed reducing the EPA's budget by 30 or 31%. And what was interesting is that when this budget went to the Republican Congress, by no means did it roll right through the Republican Congress. Instead, during the hearings, it was the Republicans, along with the Democrats, who were bringing up questions about what the implications of this kind of budget cut at this scale would be. So you had an Ohio Republican who was defending Great Lakes restoration programs, then an Idaho Republican who was raising concerns about the impact on pesticide programs, and somebody from Republican who was worried about how this would impact communities that were fighting smog. And so you can kind of go down the list, and Republicans were the ones who were raising concerns that when you get away from climate change, right, and so much of the rhetoric during the campaign was about climate and energy, when you actually look at these core issues of water pollution and air pollution and toxic waste sites and safe drinking water, Republicans, Democrats all care about these issues. And so ultimately, when Congress passed a budget, it didn't follow the Trump administration's at all in 2017. In fact, it kept basic EPA funding at the same level. Now, that isn't to say that it's clear the Trump administration has found many ways to undermine the work of the EPA over the past 2 years, but it hasn't done so in ways that have demonstrated that it has the entire Republican Party or the Congress behind it. And I think, one other piece of evidence for this is that this is kind of the golden opportunity for Republicans, right? They've got, or they had the White House and they had Congress during the last congressional session. They could have tried to move on large-scale policy reforms that they've been kind of chomping at the bit to do, right? To reform the fundamental environmental laws, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act. And very little reform or rollbacks, went through Congress. It wasn't like the start of the Reagan administration where Reagan tried to move all of this big legislation. Trump administration did not do that. Instead, they confined themselves largely to working through, these administrative pathways. So I think, there's, it suggests to me that there is, at some point, there's a backstop of support for the environment and concern amongst Republicans that has been important to curbing just any kind of strong push in Congress to kind of roll back these key laws. The other, you mentioned the midterm elections, and there are some Republicans who've supported, been concerned about climate change. And there's a Climate Solutions Caucus that's emerged over the last several years in Congress, and they've adopted a kind of a 2x2 strategy. If a member of a Democrat joins the caucus, they have to bring a Republican with them and vice versa. And public polling shows that there's a lot of concern amongst the American public about climate change, and there's concern within the people who vote Republican as well. And so this Climate Solutions Caucus had some 40-odd members or so, but after the midterm elections, half of those Republican members lost their seats in the election. And I think that's evidence, right, that our political system really rewards those who move towards the right, not towards the middle. And there are a lot of large forces in terms of how politics work, how the Republican Party has changed over the last three decades, structural changes that kind of led to this Republican reversal, and to kind of get back to a moment where we're going to have kind of a room for a good faith conservative environmentalism. I think we're going to need a lot of structural changes in terms of campaign finance and gerrymandering to make room for that kind of that kind of change politics.
Can I add to that? I think there's a. I was just to say I think there's a, what Jay's getting at is there's a real disconnect between what elected officials, particularly on the Republican side, are saying about an issue like climate change, and what the majority of voters, Republican and Democrat, want to see happen. My sense is that I think that the majority of voters in both parties and independents as well, what they would like is a bipartisan consensus on environmental policy like the one that existed in the early 1970s. They would like to see environmental issues put in the same category as, say, national defense, where everybody gets together and says, look, this is something we need to do for the good of everybody. And yet the tribal politics of outrage are, they've affected people in such a way that people end up voting for representatives who's on there, you know, someone who's on the Republican team, even if that person is advocating something in terms of environmental policy that they don't agree with.
I want to ask you both about teaching this material. Political parties are perhaps something that most people think they understand better than they do. And so teaching their history can be tricky. I think about, you know, students assuming that they're more homogenous than they are, or this idea in U.S. history about, you know, the parties switched at one point, this kind of fuzzy notion of that. So what are some of the ways that you've helped your students understand the composition of parties, how they work, and how they've changed over time?
Well, I'll say, actually, I think in a way, teaching political history, there's an advantage to teaching political history, because one of the struggles that we all have in teaching students, you know, about the past is to ask them to think about contingency, to ask them to think about context, to ask them to put themselves in the minds of someone at a particular point in time. And it's often unbearably tempting for these students to, since they know how the story turned out, to kind of pull it forward to the way things are now. But the thing about political history, particularly if you're talking about something like an election, it actually encourages students to think about that particular contest. Say, well, here was this candidate, and he had these supporters, and he was, you know, wanted to put this program into effect. But in order to win election, here were the choices that he had to make. And so, in a way, political history and Republican reversal is largely a political history. It's the sort of thing that I've found students react to quite well, because they're able to put themselves into the past in a way that's much more difficult with a lot of other historical methodologies. And one of the things we've tried to do to sort of make teaching of this book more accessible is we created a website to go along with it. And it was Jay who took the lead on that, so maybe he should say more about that.
Yeah, well, I think the goal of the website was that, you know, we had waded through all of these primary documents and, you know, interpreted them and analyzed them and assembled this narrative, but we wanted to give students who were working through our book the chance to look at these documents themselves. So the website's kind of a curation of primary documents that are all of which we drew upon in the book. So if students want to read the Powell memo, they can go and read the Powell memo, or if they want to look at the way in which the Edison Electric Institute kind of described the issue of acid rain in the early 1980s, they can go and look at that. It's there. If they want to see the transcript from the rally out in South Dakota, you know, they can find that on the website. And so it's, you know, giving students the chance to work through those materials for themselves and to compare their analysis, their understanding with ours. You know, that was a goal of the website, to put these materials at their fingertips. So the website, you know, includes these primary materials. It also includes a timeline, because, you know, one of the way this book is structured is it has three core case studies, one around clean air and clean water, one around public lands and resource development, and then one around climate change and energy. And there's also on this website, there's a timeline that then stitches these different narratives and kind of brings them into one timeline, which is a different way of looking at the story that complements the book. But our hope is that by having these materials readily available, and it's easy to find if you Google the Republican reversal on the web, that this teaching resource will really complement the book and make it easier to teach for those who want to use it in the classroom.
It's pretty unusual for two historians to co-author a book, and when they do, it's quite rare that they produce a book that's has the cohesive narrative that this one does. Could you tell us a little bit about the origins of the project and your experience collaborating?
Jay, you want to start with that?
I guess I could start on this. Is Jay? Sure, this is Jay. I'll start on the origins of the project. The origins of the project came on election night in 2016. I had been working on a different project, and immediately after the aftermath of the election, realized that no one was real interested in that project at the moment. And, you know, there were so many concerns about what was going to happen, right, with the Trump administration rolling into Washington, Republicans gaining power in Washington to environmental laws. And there'd been so much, you know, just alarming rhetoric on the campaign trail about the environment. And, you know, I kind of realized, you know, that George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan had said really crazy things about environmental issues as well. And so, you know, there was kind of precedent for this kind of alarming rhetoric. And, you know, while they had, had also tried to undo our environmental protections and had a lot of trouble and resistance in doing so. And it seemed, you know, so the motivation, kind of the origin story for the book was that it would be very useful to have a narrative both of how Republicans had tried to roll back the environmental state and how that had become so difficult because of the mobilization among environmentalists and moderate Republicans and Democrats at this particular moment when it seemed like this might happen again. And so that was kind of the origin of the book. But the collaboration part of the book was, I sent Drew, kind of said, this is what I'm thinking about. I think this would be a useful book to write. And Drew said, you know, I think you're right. That could be a useful contribution. You know, what would you think about working on this together?
And which was a completely impulsive thing on my part to say. You know, I had many of the same reactions that Jay had, and he sent me a kind of sort of proposal for the book he wanted me to look at and give him, you know, some thoughts on it. I said, this is great, but it will take you a really long time if you try to do this yourself. Do you want some help? And I didn't really think about that offer before it came out of my mouth, but there it was. And I'm glad that we did that because it actually turned out to be both a lot of fun and I just learned a lot in terms of when writing this.
There was a certain motivation in knowing that if you got up at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, as I was doing many mornings to work on this book, you know, every time I wrote a word, somebody else, Drew, was also writing a word. So I'd really written two words. And just, you know, knowing that there was an immediate audience, that, you know, somebody was going to be there to read kind of what you had produced that day or that week. Yeah, you know, that was really good motivation just in terms of keeping the project together kind of on that level. But then I think our approach, you know, our approaches as historians were complementary in ways that worked really well for this project.
Well, before I let you go, I know you're both working now that you've done this duet, now you're both working on individual, you know, monographs that are both really exciting. And I wondered if you could just tease them quickly for our listeners.
Jay's absolutely right about that, you know, you have, one has one, these moments of despair when you're writing a book, when you just think about, I'm only this far along. But then I just always reminded myself, I'm twice as far along as I think I am. And we had, this may have been a psychological trick, but we imagined a shorter book than the one that we eventually produced. And that allowed us to feel that we were a lot closer to the goal than we really were. But in terms of how we made this work, we had a flurry of emails back and forth, and we had a weekly scheduled phone conversation, which could go for an hour or more, in which we talked about what we'd written and what we were going to write next and how we thought this was going and what we wanted to emphasize and what was working and what wasn't working. And so it was about 5 or 6 months of sort of pretty close collaboration in order to get it out. And we had to put aside the other things we were working on in order to get it done.
Yeah. So this is Jay, the project that I put up on the shelf, after the election, but have taken back down since, and I'm excited to complete, as I've been working on an environmental history of batteries. And the idea there was just realizing that we were moving into this world where batteries seem to be in everything from, you know, new automobiles, you know, electric cars, to our laptops, to our cell phones. I was spending a lot of time thinking about charging things and realizing that, you know, batteries have played this enabling role in, you know, it's not just a story of 21st century sustainability, but, you know, the major systems of communication and transport and power since the start of the 20th century. And so what can we learn by looking at this longer history of batteries from the perspective of environmental history as we move into this 21st century where batteries are becoming more and more important? So the specific focus of my book is the lead acid battery, which was the real workhorse of the 20th century. And there's some, you know, really valuable lessons from how that technology, just the cost, the management, regulation of that technology as we think about batteries today.
The project that I put aside and now that I'm getting back to is, because I am a 19th and 20th century historian, I'm working on a cultural and environmental history of the American West in the first half of the 19th century. It's a number of things that I've come across in the course of researching other books, an effort to vaccinate Native Americans against smallpox, an effort to introduce camels into the Southwest in the 1850s, that struck me these kinds of, they were all kinds of weird experiments in the West that did not seem to fit the manifest destiny narrative. And I originally thought of them as just exceptions to the rule. And the more I looked at this and the more kinds of things I came up with, I realized that there are so many exceptions to the rule that there's not much left of the rule itself. So what I am writing is a kind of way of reconceiving the first part of the 19th century in the American West that sets aside manifest destiny and tries to think about it in a more complex and contingent way.
Thanks so much. Well, those are exciting projects to look forward to in the time ahead. And that's all the time we have today on New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, and I've been speaking with James Morton Turner and Andrew Eisenberg about their new collaborative work, The Republican Reversal, Conservatives and the Environment from Nixon to Trump, brand new out from Harvard University Press. They said it was longer than they expected it to be, but it's still plenty short to assign to get undergrads to read or to get friends and family to pull out of their stocking in the month ahead. And again, the teaching website that goes along with the book is at www.therepublicanreversal.com. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.